KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. There are consequences to all of our actions, positive and negative, large and small, delayed and immediate. Biopsychologist Susan Schneider talks about how consequences follow certain scientific principles. Schneider is the author of The Science of Consequences, How They Affect Genes, Change the Brain, and Impact Our World. Schneider spoke at Seattle's Town Hall on July 11th, 2013.
As you can tell from the title of my book, this science covers a lot of ground. This evening, I will only cover some of the highlights. A consequence is any outcome that depends on a behavior. Just turning your head so you can enjoy the view out the window is an example. That consequence of looking at the view depends on your behavior of turning your head. Working for a paycheck is another example. Turning on the tube to enjoy your favorite program. Playing with your puppy, and in conversation, ideally, mutually rewarding consequences keep the conversation going. They're everywhere, consequences. Just as consequences come in all shapes and sizes, so do the dimensions that we can categorize them on. These are just a few. The last two, I think, may require some additional explanation. Some behaviors are intrinsically rewarding. So you might work or pay for the opportunity to go dancing, for example. Other consequences are extrinsic. A paycheck, for example, comes from outside, frequently for behavior that is not quite as intrinsically rewarding. And the last category, even though it may seem like we're aware of a lot of the consequences for what we do, researchers have shown quite clearly, there's a large database, that many times we are influenced for the consequences of our actions without even being aware that it is having this influence. All the more reason to learn about this science and to become aware. When you look out the window, you see a view every time. Even at night, there's something. Most behaviors do not produce the consequence every single time. The relationship is more complex. Frequently, there might be a signal, and when the signal is present, it's easier to get the consequence. For example, when you go fishing, you may have learned that when you see a lot of little fish jumping, that's a signal that that's a good place and time to cast your lure, because you're more likely to get a strike and be reinforced. So quite frequently, there are signals for the availability of consequences. Even in the case of the fishing example, though, not every cast is going to produce a strike. And the relationship between the behavior and the consequence is described as a schedule. Usually, it's not like looking out the window where every behavior produces the consequence. You might have to cast 5 times or 35 times before you get a strike. It's a variable schedule of consequences, and it's work-based because you have to cast each time. You can't just wait. This particular schedule of consequences turns out to be quite common in everyday life. Whether you read the newspaper online or the old-fashioned way, you might have to look through several articles before you find one that's rewarding enough to read all the way through. It's another variable work-based schedule. Here's a classic example. Certainly, you don't win a prize every time you pull on the slot machine. It's a variable schedule also, but if you pull frequently enough, often enough, and you know, eventually you will get the reward. That, again, is work-based because you have to actually pay the money and pull on the lever in order to keep trying for the reward. They're all over the place. This particular schedule tends to produce a relatively high, steady rate of behavior And that turns out to be the case across individual people and across a wide range of animal species. Also across a wide range of different behaviors and consequences. There are many applications just of this one schedule, and there are many different kinds of schedules of consequences, all with different applications in the real world. I'll mention just one, the design of video games. Believe me, those people know about this area of this science, and this is just one small part of it. Here's another aspect of consequences that we frequently find rather annoying. You may work to get a consequence, but it won't happen immediately. There's a delay. In fact, quite frequently, there might be both immediate and delayed consequences and different behaviors you could be doing. And on a societal level, as well as individually, as we'll see in a moment, this can create big problems because delayed consequences lose their value compared to what their delay would be if they were available immediately. $100 a year from now simply does not have the same impact as $100 immediately. Overfishing is a great example of this principle of how delay affects consequence value. This is a graph of the cod catch for the Grand Banks fishery off the northeast coast of North America. Now, for centuries, this was a very reliable resource. And our reliable data go back as far as 1850. So that's when this graph begins, 1850. You can see that for decades, the catch increased. Oops. There we go. But rather slowly and steadily, and the fishery was still sustained. Uh-oh. Okay, are we okay? Then, in the 1960s, look at this big spike. Wow. More fishing boats using higher-tech fishing gear were catching a lot more fish, and fishery scientists started to sound the warning that this might be a problem for the fishery. However, through most of this period, this fishery was self-regulated, which, unfortunately, as is often the case, in practice meant not regulated. And the fishing boats simply kept on catching as much as they could. The immediate consequences for them are clear. They made a bigger immediate profit. What happened, though, you can see, was really striking. The fishery scientists were right, and in 1992, this fishery crashed. It's now 21 years later, and this fishery has still not recovered. Many scientists think that it never will, and that we have permanently altered this ecosystem. And of course, the long-term consequences for those fishing boats were utterly disastrous. When do you think that effective regulations with real consequences for breaking them, got passed, limiting the catch so that the fishery would have a chance at being sustainable? This fishery crashed in 1992. Does anyone want to make a guess as to what year the effective regulations got passed? Yeah, okay. I'm hearing a lot of guesses that are after 1992. And unfortunately, we are cynical with good reason. We know how hard it is to choose the larger later reward in this kind of choice situation. And in fact, the regulations did get passed in 1992, not in the 2000s, but only after the fishery had crashed, right? And it was too late. On an individual basis, we face the same choice between an immediate reward that's smaller, a smaller sooner reward, we call it, or a larger later reward. And most of us in this room, if not all of us, I think can testify, this may sound easy, but it's not. When you're standing in line looking at a tempting piece of cherry pie, it can be very difficult to remember that you're trying to stick to a diet. So, this problem starts young. Walter Mischel is very well known for this series of studies, the marshmallow study, with 4-year-old children. Individually, they were placed in a room with a tempting marshmallow on a plate. They could wait 15 minutes and not eat it, and then they would get 2 marshmallows. But guess how many managed to wait those 15 minutes? Not a whole lot. Years later, Michelle found that, other things being equal, children who had managed to wait even 10 minutes compared to 5 minutes did substantially better on their college prep scores, like the SAT. And we all know, I think, from our own experience, how valuable it is to be able to exert that kind of self-control and wait for the larger, later reward and not just impulsively grab the immediate, smaller reward. How can we help the kids to achieve this? Michelle and a number of other people in psychology and in other disciplines have developed some very effective methods. And of course, for adults as well, there's a whole range of techniques that we can use to help ourselves achieve these longer-term goals. This list is of methods that all involve consequences, as you can see. They're all based, at least in part, on the science of consequences, and they all have extensive research support.
Susan Schneider, the author of The Science of Consequences, How They Affect Genes, Change the Brain, and Impact Our World. Schneider spoke at Town Hall on July 11th, 2013. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of her talk by going to kuow.org/speakersforum. Posey Gruner recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9, Seattle.
KUOW 818, I'm Guy Nelson. Seattle weather tonight, some clouds and low temperatures in the 50s. We'll have some morning clouds tomorrow, and then mostly sunny in the afternoon with highs in the low 80s. Coming up later tonight on KUOW, the mother of a Nova Scotia teenager who took her own life after allegedly being raped, then bullied online, gives her reaction to the arrests of two of the teenage boys said to be involved in the incident. And actor and activist George Takei tells us why he thinks, in light of Russia's new anti-gay law, the 2014 Olympic Games should be moved to another city like Vancouver. We'll also hear from the director of the Detroit Institute of Art, telling us about the suggestion that the museum's collection be sold to help the cash-strapped city. That's all ahead in the 11 o'clock hour tonight. 94.9 KUOW, Seattle.
Did you know you can support KUOW through a planned gift? By making a planned gift to KUOW, you help ensure that public radio remains available in our community for years to come. For more information on how you can make a planned gift while receiving financial benefits today, go to kuow.org/future.
I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. Our actions have consequences, and those consequences tend to follow a set of scientific principles. That's the argument of biopsychologist Susan Schneider. Schneider's new book is called The Science of Consequences, How They Affect Genes, Change the Brain, and Impact Our World. Schneider spoke at Seattle's Town Hall on July 11th, 2013.
So my book has two themes. First, as I hope you're already seeing, consequences really are everywhere. There is a science that applies to them, which it turns out has been around for over a century now. And there's a huge, huge range of beneficial applications for people and for animals alike. Second, I think, and equally important, though, is the fact that this ability to learn from the consequences of our actions is an important part of the flexibility in the larger nature and nurture system. And in this talk now, I'm going to be starting with that, and then we will come back to everyday consequences. There will be a quiz on this. This is a diagram of the parts of a rat brain that are involved in the dopamine system. Now, dopamine is one of those neurotransmitters. These are chemicals that transmit neural impulses across the little gaps between neurons. Dopamine is just one of a number of neurotransmitters that neuroscientists have demonstrated help support learning from consequences. The message here is that it's complicated. Many different parts of the brain are involved, including the so-called pleasure centers, and I will be talking about that in a moment. Now, this is a rat brain, but it turns out that all mammalian brains really have a lot of the same basic structure in common. And in fact, that even applies to a surprisingly large extent across vertebrates in general. In the inset here, we're looking at what's happening neurochemically between individual neurons. And here again, we know that learning from consequences promotes something called long-term potentiation. And that means faster, stronger connections between two neurons when you learn from consequences. And I will talk more in a bit about other effects of learning from consequences on the brain. First, let's look more at the pleasure centers. When you enjoy music, or get money, or gaze at a beautiful face, who knows who this is? Very good. Or when you enjoy a wide range of positive reinforcers, similar activity occurs in your pleasure centers. And that is the case across individual people, and again, across a wide range of animal species. Turn it around and insert a teeny microelectrode in one of the pleasure centers, and all of these species and many more will work for the opportunity to get that stimulation. Note that this includes not only people, but even invertebrates like snails. Let's look at genes. You may have a gene, and if during your lifetime it never gets transcribed to produce the protein that it codes for, and as far as you're concerned, you may as well not have it. So the ability to activate genes so that they do get read and transcribed to produce their proteins is a critical part of the genetic system. Well, we now know of hundreds of examples where environmental factors, including signals for consequences and behavior, can do this. They can activate and deactivate genes. Many hundreds of examples now. I've selected these three because they all have been demonstrated in people as well as in other animal species, and they all involve consequences. Just looking at the last example, you might exercise to avoid nagging by your spouse, or because it feels good, or because you're trying for that larger later of staying at a healthy weight or getting down to a healthy weight, or just to get from point A to point B. It's very much influenced by consequences, and once you do, about 2 hours later, this gene gets activated as a result, and it adjusts the metabolism in those muscles. So you can turn on this gene at will. It's a system. This is a photograph of wild rhesus monkeys in India. Steve Sumi had a colony where he could follow the young monkeys as they were raised either by foster mothers or by each other. Now, that's not a good idea for young monkeys any more than it would be for humans. The focus of the series of studies was this gene, which we have, as well as these monkeys. Serotonin is another of those neurotransmitters that is involved with learning from consequences. It influences behavior and emotion. The short form of this gene has long been considered to be bad. And indeed, as these monkeys grew, Sumi noted that those who had the short form, other things being equal, when they were raised by each other, were more likely to be impulsive. So given a choice between a smaller sooner and a larger later, like the marshmallows for the 4-year-olds, they grabbed and they didn't wait. They made the more foolish choice. They also found alcohol more reinforcing than the other monkeys. They were more aggressive, and they did not do well in the dominance hierarchy. However, illustrating the complexities and nonlinear interactions, the mess, really, that all of these interactions in the system produce, take a look at that. The same short gene form that was such a problem when they were raised by each other turned out to have benefits when these young monkeys were raised by mothers. They were less likely to be impulsive, they were less likely to find alcohol reinforcing, etc. It's a system. Everything is interacting. Impulsivity and aggression, of course, are influenced by consequences as well as all of these other factors. And these two things, dominant hierarchies and parenting, also have plenty of consequences. This one series of studies has almost everything interacting. Let's look now mainly at the neurophysiology. In this study, some rats were randomly assigned to learn to navigate an obstacle course. These were the acrobatic rats. They had to learn to get around these barriers, and then there was a food reward at the end of the runway. So there was a lot of learning from consequences. The second group, the exercise group, moved around just as much, but they didn't have to learn any obstacle course. The third group just stayed at home. So the focus here was what happened in just a few select samples from the motor cortex of these rats. The motor cortex is a part of the brain that helps underlie any kind of learning that involves movement, muscular movement. And we're looking here at the number of synapses per neuron in these sample areas. The two control groups started out with about 7,000 synapses per neuron, which is pretty typical for mammals, by the way, and they pretty much stayed at that level throughout the study. See, here we go. Look what happened to the acrobatic rats, though. Significantly higher. Clearly, all that extra learning from consequences caused a lot of new synapses to be created. And those new synapses stayed right throughout the length of the study. These findings and other similar findings have been replicated many times now, including in people. Learning from consequences can reliably create new connections in our brains. And let's look at an example of this marvelous brain flexibility in people. In this study, everyone learned Braille intensively, and that, of course, is a touch task. Half of the participants in this study were randomly assigned to wear blindfolds 24 hours a day for 5 days. In this graph, we're looking at an fMRI measure of brain activity in the visual cortex, which normally handles vision. We're looking at the difference in brain activity for the people who were blindfolded compared to the people who were not. And at the end of 5 days, look at the difference in brain activity. What's happened is that the visual cortex at this point for the blindfolded group has gone 5 full days without any visual stimulation because they're wearing the blindfolds 24 hours a day. And so, at this point, they're having the fMRI measurements taken while they're working on the Braille task. The visual cortex is flexible enough to start handling touch. Yeah. And we now know that even while there are limits, of course, to the flexibility in the brain, there's a lot more than neuroscientists used to think even just 20, 30 years ago. There is a lot of flexibility in our brains and in the brains of other species with wonderful implications. Now, after that last reading that I showed you for the final graph point, at that point, the blindfolded group has been without blindfolds for 24 hours. They must have been pretty happy about that. And there's no longer a statistically significant difference in their brain activity for for the visual cortex when they're working on Braille. So already, just within one day, they're heading back to normal quite quickly. So the very fact that the visual cortex is this flexible, along with the speed of the change, is something that has a lot of significance. And again, it's certainly been replicated many times, and there are many beneficial applications, and I will now show you one. In this study, we're looking at a new therapy for victims of stroke. Now, after a stroke, quite frequently half of the body might be paralyzed, including your arm. And it turns out that most people do retain or regain at least a small amount of flexibility, at least a small amount of movement, residual movement in their afflicted arm. So what we're looking at here is two groups that have been matched for their degree of initial disability in their arms after they've had a stroke. Now the top group is getting a new therapy called constraint-induced movement therapy. And with this therapy, the good arm is constrained, making the consequences for using the bad arm a lot more powerful. And in this therapy, based on the science of consequences, positive reinforcement methods are used to systematically build on or shape more movement, starting with just that small amount that they all have at the beginning of the study, and then building on that. There are techniques that have been developed thanks to this science, and you can see the result. We're looking here at ratings using a standardized scale for arm movement. And in 10 intense days of training, the group getting the new therapy just had a huge gain in their ability to move their afflicted arms, with corresponding increases in their quality of life and ability to do everyday activities. For the following month, there's very good maintenance of their newfound ability. And 2 years later, they've lost some ground, but they're still way above where the control group was. Subsequent studies have replicated these findings many times. In addition, subsequent studies have found changes in the brain driven by this new therapy, which takes advantage of the flexibility from learning from consequences. You can see why the American Stroke Association has described this new therapy as revolutionary. And if that sounds like science fiction, wait till you hear this. In this study, two monkeys learned to play essentially a video game. And I might add, video games are used for behavioral enrichment sometimes in zoos for monkeys and apes. The monkeys had to learn to use a joystick to move a cursor on the screen and track a moving object. They got orange juice as a reward for getting better at this task. And again, presumably it was to, at least to some extent, intrinsically rewarding also. Now meanwhile, you can see they've got something attached to their heads. Those same teeny little microelectrodes were inserted painlessly in key parts of their brains, so the computer was tracking what was going on when they were moving the joystick and playing the game. Once both monkeys became proficient at the game, the joystick was removed. Now, in order to play the game and get the orange juice, they had to think about moving the cursor. Because, of course, the computer had been tracking what had happened in their brains when they moved the joystick. They had to produce those same kinds of patterns to move the cursor. Could they do it? Well, it took a while, but both monkeys eventually successfully made the transition, and in fact, they soon stopped moving their arms, and they became almost as proficient with thought control as they had been with the joystick, which I think is just amazing. Rats had been able to do a simpler version of this task, and of course, the next step was to test it in people. This is a quote from the first recipient of this brain gate implant. His apartment was set up so not only could he do things on his computer with his thoughts, but he could change the channels on his TV. One woman has now had this implant for 5 years And she was recently interviewed on CBS 60 Minutes. Some of you may have seen that. So thinking, of course, has consequences, but they're usually not nearly as obvious as they are in this case. And of course, there's many other biomedical applications of the science, but let me turn now to just three examples from psychological conditions. In depression, things that used to be rewarding become much less so. That is one of the primary criteria of depression. There are many therapies for depression. They all involve consequences to some degree. You can't avoid consequences, as I hope you're seeing. However, some therapies are based more directly on this science than others, and this is one. I don't have time to go into details, but among its more important components is simply keeping people who are depressed doing things that they used to find rewarding, even though they may not be anymore. So exercising, socializing, even getting chores done, reading, all of these things. That is one of the components. And this is considered to be a well-established therapy. In fact, I'm in with the Kaiser Permanente insurance, and last time I was in there, you know, they've got those little videos like they do in some clinics, and they were talking all about behavioral activation therapy. It does have a lot of research support and is helping a lot of people. Anytime someone is addicted to anything, whether it's legal or illegal, that substance obviously becomes a very powerful reward. How do you help people who are hooked on something really serious like heroin or cocaine to kick the habit? And for many of these people, they may be disadvantaged, they're in awful environments, they don't have good job skills, they don't have jobs. How can you get them to go off drugs when that may be one of the few reinforcers in their lives? Well, it turns out, again, all the therapies involve consequences, you can't help it, but some are more directly based on the science of consequences than others are, and this one, contingency management, is one that has a lot of research support. A meta-analysis is a statistical way of comparing treatments for the same disorder and seeing which does better, basically. And this one won for this particular 2008 study, and in fact it has been adopted by the English National Health Service and is considered to be one of the standard approaches to treating drug addiction. There's still a relatively high relapse rate, though. This is just a very big problem with huge societal costs as well as costs to those individuals. What does the therapy consist of? Again, I don't have time to go into the details, but the main idea is, first of all, to provide rewards for becoming drug-free. So there's all kinds of ways that they do that. It's a positive reinforcement-based approach. And then, once you start to get drug-free, you provide job skills and even kind of sheltered workshop kind of jobs that then those people can transition from into the more everyday workplace and everyday living conditions. And again, it's certainly not a panacea, but this approach has had significant success. I have to talk about autism as my third example. These days, some estimates are as many as 1 in 88 children in many nations are being diagnosed with autism spectrum disorders at a very young age. In this classic 1987 study, children who were about age 3, who were in this early intensive behavioral treatment group, got 40 hours a week of positive reinforcement-based therapy for 4 years. So when they say intense, they mean intense. The skills that were the focus were just basic social skills, language skills, academic skills, you name it, depending on where the kids were starting from and then building on that from there. And at the end of 4 years, nearly half of this group had gained over 30 IQ points, and they were able to be included in regular classrooms, and years later, most of that group continued to be testing in the normal range in most respects and doing quite well. And this study has now been replicated many times. Again, typically a third to nearly a half of the children respond this strongly, and can be mainstreamed. The term revolutionary, again, has been used, and you can see why organizations like the Surgeon General's Office, the American Academy of Pediatrics, and many others consider this consequence-based approach the treatment of choice. I want to focus for a moment, though, on the kids who were not in that one-third to one-half. What about the other kids? They were getting the same treatment. Why didn't they improve as much? Well, they still did improve, but only perhaps gaining 10 or 15 IQ points. They weren't able to be included in regular classrooms. And again, the replications also had the same finding. Why the difference? Why do some kids respond so strongly and others respond but not as much? Is it genetics? Is it pesticides? Both of those reasons have been suggested. We still really don't know. But what we do know is it's a system, everything's interacting, and right now, the best way to take advantage of the flexibility in the system is by using these methods based on the science of consequences. And I know there's people in this room that do this kind of work, and it's really a wonderful thing to see.
Susan Schneider, the author of The Science of Consequences, How They Affect Genes, Change the Brain, and Impact Our World. Schneider spoke at Town Hall on July 11th, 2013. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of her talk by going to kuow.org/speakersforum. Posey Gruner recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9, Seattle.
More from Susan Schneider in a moment. KUOW 94.9 Seattle. I'm Guy Nelson. It's 8:43. Seattle weather tonight, some clouds moving in, but we'll have some clearness later on. And then as morning approaches, morning clouds and afternoon sunshine. Highs tomorrow in the low 80s. Later tonight, Attorney General Eric Holder says harsh punishment for drug crimes is devastating to communities of color, and he's calling for reforms. We'll have a conversation about the debate over mandatory minimum sentencing on the Diane Rehm Show. It starts at midnight. Seattle weather for the weekend, it'll be a mix of sunshine and clouds with a chance of rain on Saturday and Sunday. High temperatures will be in the low 80s, and on Saturday we might even see a thunderstorm in Seattle. 94.9 KUOW.
Join KUOW for Green Stage's 25th year of Shakespeare in the Park with A Midsummer Night's Dream, King Lear, and Backyard Bard productions of Twelfth Night and The Merry Wives of Windsor. Nearly 60 performances in 22 Puget Sound area parks, July 12th through August 17th. More on the events page at KUOW.org.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. Susan Schneider is a biopsychologist and the author of The Science of Consequences, How They Affect Genes, Change the Brain, and Impact Our World. She spoke at Seattle's Town Hall on July 11th, 2013.
So, let's look now at language in everyday life. And I think this slide speaks for itself. It starts even younger. Researchers find that parents just naturally reinforce the babbling sounds that their babies make. Was that a da-da I heard? Right? So in this classic early study, a researcher decided to look at what would happen if only babbling sounds that were mainly vowel or babbling sounds that were mainly consonant were reinforced. would the babbling sounds change as a result? 10 children were randomly assigned to each group. The children were 3 to 7 months in age. The reinforcement was smiling at the baby, patting the baby, and making an approving sound. And an independent observer separately categorized all of the babbling sounds, you know, again, as mainly vowel or mainly consonant. So here we have the results. We're looking here at the difference between vowels and consonants. So when results go higher, that means there's relatively more vowels. And indeed, this top group is the group that had only babbling sounds that were mainly vowel reinforced. And they start out already producing more vowel sounds, you can see in the beginning here. So this is not what you want to see when you're a researcher. But in this case, it really didn't matter because it's so clear that the reinforcement, in fact, worked and those babies responded to it. This bottom group is the consonant group. They're doing relatively more consonants and fewer vowels. That's why their line goes down. The middle group had all babbling sounds reinforced, so not surprisingly, they stay at about the same level when you compare vowels and consonants. These results have also been replicated many times, most recently by a researcher from Cornell using sonograms for more detail. In the next stage, there's also plenty of consequences. And my friend and colleague Ernst Merck did this study looking at a large database where interactions between a mother and her daughter Eve were audio taped over the period when Eve was learning language, a huge database. So based on a statistical analysis, Merck found that each of the basic grammatical sentence types occurred many times just per day, let alone per month, and instances like mom saying a word, Eve imitating it, and then mom approving in some way occurred many times greater than you would expect from chance. So there's just no question that there is a lot of natural teaching going on. Building on earlier studies like that, we have this classic study that is sometimes considered one of the most important psychology studies of the 20th century, and I would certainly concur with that. Hardin Risley developed a Head Start program for disadvantaged children who typically would enter at about age 3 and a half. They found that already at that age, there were what they called meaningful differences in the language skills of the children. And children who started out behind had trouble catching up and staying caught up. So where were these differences coming from? They did this study to find out. They had these families followed. These are the families who stuck it out for the whole time period. And they had observers in the households recording what was going on for 1 hour a month as one child in the family developed from age 8 or 9 months to 3 years. In addition, the observers, usually the same one for each family throughout this time period, recorded everything that was happening. So this was a huge, huge database. Now these 42 families covered quite a range of backgrounds, and that's going to be important. So the researchers looked at all of this history of language interaction to try and pick out what seemed to be associated with later language success. And they found 5 critical factors. 2 of these were primarily structural, like the range of vocabulary used by the parents, but 3 were more functional, and that means they had something to do with the consequences produced by the child's language. For example, guidance style meant whether the parents more frequently asked questions or made demands, thus setting the child up for different kinds of consequences. Feedback tone, which I'm going to come back to in a moment, simply referred to whether the tone was positive or negative. So essentially, the positives to negatives ratio. And finally, responsiveness simply measured the degree to which the parents provided consequences when their children said something. As Hardin and Risley were careful to point out, all of the families were doing the best that they could for their children. But some families were better equipped to provide enriched environments, in particular in the three socioeconomic categories in the study, the professional families, in fact, just looking at sheer language volume, talked to their kids a lot more and did better on these five critical factors. They were better equipped to provide an enriched environment, and on average, they did provide a more enriched environment. And in fact, looking at the difference in sheer language volume, just hundreds of words per hour difference in the amount of language directed at the children for the professional families compared to the families on assistance. That means many more learning opportunities. Encouragingly, though, the working class, which was the largest group in between, covered the whole range in between in terms of the volume of language and the critical factors. And in fact, what made the difference for these children's language skills later on was not socioeconomic status or race or gender or birth order or family size. It was the language learning environment. Kids who had more enriched environments did better regardless of all those other factors. And here's the results. A correlation can at maximum be one if you have a perfect degree of relationship that when one factor changes, the other changes too. When we're looking at IQ at age 3 and at this standardized test of language skills, the test retest reliability, to get a little technical here, is only in the 0.8s. So this level of degree of relationship between this combined measure of those five critical factors and these two outcomes, IQ at age 3 and these language test results 6 years later, this is about as high a predictive relationship as you can ever get. I mean, really, the researchers were blown away. If you have an enriched environment, you're just far more likely to have a higher IQ at age 3 and better language skills. It was a very direct relationship. Think about the implications of this. Imagine if we could give every child on this planet an enriched environment. This, of course, was a correlational study that cannot demonstrate cause and effect. We were just looking at what was happening naturally. However, subsequent experimental studies that can demonstrate cause and effect have verified the importance of these five critical factors, and large-scale projects like Harlem Children's Zone are taking advantage and building on these results. How many have heard of Harlem Children's Zone? Can you raise your hands? Great, I do see a number of you who have. Yeah, it's very encouraging. The idea, on the one hand, is to try and provide extra enrichment for children in disadvantaged families so they don't get behind to begin with. And on the other hand, for children who did get behind, to provide extra enrichment and help so that they can compensate for the early disadvantage and catch up. And these projects are enjoying significant success. It's very encouraging. There's some real implications here for all of us, too. It turns out all of us really have a lot of potential that we could be taking advantage of. Research in a variety of areas shows that not just for so-called intelligence, which is a process and not a thing, by the way, but in a variety of areas of human expertise, that if you provide an enriched environment and extra consequences for motivation and good teaching, that people can just accomplish at a high level. This does in fact seem to be what mainly distinguishes people who become experts for researchers in this area of expertise, like Anders Ericsson. Some of you may have heard of him. Just looking at IQ, experiments have shown that if you do provide extra consequences for extra motivation to disadvantaged kids in particular, they can gain like up to 10 IQ points right off the bat. Experiments have also demonstrated that good teaching and more teaching reliably increases IQ, so does proper nutrition, and the Flynn effect documents the same thing on a much larger scale, essentially. For those of you who may not be familiar with it, over the many decades in the 20th century, the average IQ in the general population of many developed nations increased by about 3 points per decade. And it doesn't take long until that becomes very significant indeed. In this nation now, the average IQ test taker does better. Let me rephrase that. 98% of us now in this country do better on the IQ test than the average IQ test taker a century ago. 98%. That's not because our genes have changed. That's because we're doing better with nutrition, public education, computers, etc. And encouragingly, some of the developing nations like Kenya have recently been documented to have the Flynn effect also, because they're doing better with nutrition and public education too.
Susan Schneider, the author of The Science of Consequences, How They Affect Genes, Change the Brain, and Impact Our World. Schneider spoke at Town Hall on July 11th, 2013. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of her talk by going to kuow.org/speakersforum. Posey Gruner recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9, Seattle.
KUOW and Nature Consortium present the Arts in Nature Festival at Camp Long, August 10th and 11th, featuring dance, interactive arts, and acoustic performances by Cloud Cult, Lila Vision, and many others. Learn more on the events page at kuow.org.
858. This is KUOW Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services. Coming up tomorrow night on Radiolab, stories about the dark side of human nature and whether it's something we can ever really understand or fully escape, including the chilling statistic that 91% of men and 84% of women have fantasized about killing someone. Also, a look at one particular fantasy lurking behind these numbers and the story of a man who chased one of the most prolific serial killers in U.S. history. That's on Radiolab on KUOW tomorrow night at 7. And then later on Friday night, singer-songwriter Madeleine Peru started out busking on the streets of Paris. Today, she's an acclaimed performer whose voice has been characterized as instantly recalling the golden age of radio, no matter what the tune. On this edition of Song Travels, Madeleine Peru talks about the importance of Ray Charles as a musical mentor, and she joins Michael Feinstein for her song, I'm Gonna Sit Right Down and Write Myself a Letter. That's 8 o'clock Friday night on Song Travels with Michael Feinstein.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at kuow.org.